quick 15-second promo for Purple Stride in April. Go!
PurpleStride.org.
/team trick.
We're a team! We're a team!
There's our leader, Kitty! Our vision of hope!
Hey, this is Terry Farrell of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I'm here to invite you to join me and the Inglorious Trekspurts as we go on the ultimate road trek, visiting the most iconic Star Trek locations ever filmed. We'll share fun facts about scenes that were filmed there, their incredible Hollywood histories. We may even fight a Gorn or two along the way. We have many special guests from Star Trek movies and series. You can reserve your copy of this epic new documentary on Blu-ray or DVD, along with a gaggle of intergalactic rewards, such as Ernie, the pet Vasquez rock, limited edition collector pins, cool sci-fi swag, autographs, of course, and so much more by going to makethetrek.com and supporting us as we boldly go to the greatest Star Trek locations ever filmed. Go to makethetrek.com and let's see what's out there. Engage.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
This is Darren Dockerman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Trekspurts, and this is The Search for Chekhov with Walter Koenig as we continue our celebration of all things Star Trek III for the 40th anniversary. And when we had the chance to sit down with Walter Koenig again on stage at GalaxyCon Columbus last December, we specifically decided to focus in this conversation with Walter on Star Trek III and his role in the Star Trek Generations movie, currently celebrating its 30th anniversary this year.
Wow.
And Walter, as is always the case, did not disappoint. He had great stories, and he had a new story that had literally just happened hours earlier, where him and Bill Shatner had a short but sweet conversation about Bill's role in Star Trek Generations. And I love what Walter has to say.
Yeah.
But you'll hear it for yourself when you hear the conversation. But that was great to hear. That was great to hear. It's funny because Walter, I think, has made it very clear that he's a subscriber to the Shatner philosophy of life. He's smiling more. He's getting out more. He's doing things. He's enjoying the love that's being lavished on him by the fans, right. And it's energized him.
It's like we're watching him. I think in real time, like, but not really real time. It's more like
awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And it's happening like from convention to convention. I was fortunate enough to like to spend a few minutes with him, like to help him with his bags, you know, at bag claim, and just having a lovely
Did you go? I don't got it.
Yeah, no, but he was just, you know, it just, we have to talk to him sometime just about his experiences being a writer. He is the crankiest, most Bartleby writer of all time, and is just glorious. But yeah, I could tell like that he just loved every second of his experience with that. Like, maybe we'll do it as part of our Deck 78 Powers of Matthew Starr retrospective.
When we were backstage watching the cut sequence of Kirk's mile-high skydive, he was looking at it and he says, where did you get this? That's me. he hadn't seen it before. Is this in the movie? I said, no, it's a cut scene. Oh my God, where did you guys get this? I said, well, you know, we have our ways. But it was so sweet because he was discovering this on his own, and it was magical.
That is so funny. That's the first time he saw the orbit diving sequence from Generations. And he had great stories about Generations as well as Star Trek III. And, you know, his opinion of Star Trek III is somewhat like our own. He's not a huge fan of that movie. But, of course, because of his own perspective, that Chekhov, after Star Trek II, where he has such a large role, you know, he sort of comes down to earth on Star Trek III. There's a lot less Chekhov.
A bit of a bring down.
Yeah. But he has great insights about working with Leonard in the making of that film, as does he does about Generations, which is a movie, as he tells us, he turned down. And you'll find out why when you listen to this fantastic conversation with Walter Koenig as we celebrate the anniversaries of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Star Trek Generations, and the new Walter, right after these brief commercial messages.
Star Wars figures, R2-D2, Chewbacca, Luke, and Princess Leia. They're the Star Wars early bird set of figures. These action figures are not yet available, but this Star Wars early bird certificate package is in stores. With this colorful Star Wars picture display stand and certificate, to send in to get a set of figures by mail. They'll be sent to you at home between February 1st and June 1st. The Star Wars early bird certificate package, new from Kenner.
At the edge of the universe, 400 men and women are probing the immeasurable blackness of space. Their leaders are an Earthman with no fear and a stranger with no heart. Travel beyond our time and solar system into new galaxies, into worlds beyond your dreams. Star Trek, every week in color on the NBC television network.
The Trexperts are back on the road again as
we're
our
back.
Inglourious.
We're back, baby.
We're back. The Inglourious Live Tour continues in 2024. And we're visiting some great cities near you. So don't miss a chance to get exclusive Trexperts merchandise, autograph posters, and see us moderate conversations with the biggest stars in the Trek universe coming to a galaxy or at least a city near you this year, including Richmond, Virginia, Anaheim, California for WonderCon, Oklahoma City, May 24th through 26th, San Diego, California, for Comic-Con with Mark and Ashley, July 24th to 28th. But if Mark and Ashley aren't your cup of tea, well, where are they going to find you, Darren?
Well, I'm going to be in Raleigh, North Carolina, July 25th through 28th. Me only.
Wow.
It's the Trexpert Tour.
You get Darren all to yourself.
Yeah,
and then we'll all be reuniting, and it feels so good, in San Jose, California, August
18th
to the 18th.
I know the way
to San Jose. And maybe we'll go up north to look for the nuclear vessels while we're there. Well, and we're bringing it on all home in Columbus, Ohio, December 6th to the 8th. So if you want to know what guests will be joining us and how to get tickets, go to galaxycon.com, comic-con.org, or trexpressplus.com. You'll be glad you did. We'll see you around the galaxy. Hey, if you're a fan of the Inglourious Trexperts, you don't want to miss Deck 78, our subscriber-only podcast, which deals with pop culture and Trek-adjacent subjects. It's a pretty spectacular podcast with amazing guests and conversation every other week. And the only way to get it is to subscribe today. So go to trexpertsplus.com. That's trexpertsplus.com to subscribe to Deck 78. Fire the rockets.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But more importantly, a true legend of stage and screen. And we are so glad to once again welcome him to the stage here at GalaxyCon, the great Walter Koenig. Welcome, Walter. Well, we thought... we thought, Walter, it would be interesting when we talked to you this time that it's the 30th anniversary of Generations in 2024. It's also the 40th anniversary of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. So we can talk about the Pushkin collar and all that stuff. But
absolutely.
But let's talk about generations, because I know there's a curious story behind. Obviously, not the idea was to bring back all of you. Not everyone right. came back. Leonard didn't come back. He was mad at Rick Berman. DeForest Kelly didn't want to be part of it for various reasons. You came back, and there's this very scene we just watched, which was excised from the film. Yeah. Tell us what that was like. You said it was interesting to be a guest star on your own set. You'd never had that experience with Star Trek before.
Well, first of all, what evidently is not... Hi, everybody. What evidently is not known is that I turned it down, too. Mm. I didn't see the point. You know, I think I consider myself relatively cynical and pragmatic about life, and I don't tear up easy. That's bullshit. I do tear up easy. But my sense was that being in Generations was not contributing to the history of the character. The way it was written, it was obviously just a pragmatic decision made to draw in original fans, you know, bring in Scotty and bring in Chekhov was just to sweeten the pot for new fans. So I said no, and I thought that was the end of it. I don't play games about things like that, and I got a call from Berman, Mr. Berman, and he said, why don't you want to come aboard? And I said, because it's not contributing to the history of the character. And they were offering me a substantial amount of money. The thing is, I felt it was more important to create something than to just generate money. You know, it was just the way I was feeling. So they said, what would change your mind? I said, we could have a scene where we learn a little bit more about who Chekhov is. This is the last time you're ever going to see him. And that's what I thought. And I said, he's always been an expositional character. That is, a character who's there, whose purpose is to help promote the plot, but not to give us insight into who the character is. You know, there's never the pronoun I. It's, you know, it's always kept and there is something out there. And then the I comes, well, I'm going to find out what it is. So that was my feeling. He says, well, what if we wrote a scene? I said, okay, and the scene should be so we would not distort the story or in any way subvert it and go in some other direction, become a Chekhov story. And I knew that was never going to happen, and nor did I want it to happen. But if Jimmy and I, if Scotty and Chekhov could have a moment when Kirk is blown out of the ship to express our feelings of losing our captain, I said, that would make it worthwhile for me. Then Chekhov... what we know a little bit more about him than we ever learn with him pushing buttons, you know. So they said, okay, so come on in and we'll discuss the scene. So I came in and the writer was there and Mr. Berman, and I told him what I would like to see. Literally, folks, 30 seconds. It was 30 seconds about how we've lost our captain. They wrote it. We got on the set. I may be the only person in the world who liked the director. I thought he was terrific because he actually said something. He talked to the actors. I don't want to digress because I'll lose my train of thought and I won't even know that I'm here, you know. So the scene was, you know, Captain Kirk is gone, he's dead, and we have a moment in exchange to talk about the loss we felt. And frankly, I had been going through a very, very severe loss in my life. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that I employed those moments when, between Scotty and I to express the loss in my own life, which is, I'm not sure is morally okay. I mean, that's what actors are supposed to do, draw from your own life and to give the performance that is feels authentic. But it felt a little exploitive to me. At the same time, I was really feeling what was happening. I mean, it's the only time in my life that I had tears on screen. And we shot it several times, and the director was very, I thought it was really good. And the last time he said, let's do it without the tears. And I said, okay. And we did it that way. Well, it didn't matter. It was all academic because they cut it. And I wasn't totally surprised. I wasn't disillusioned. I wasn't bitter about it. Notwithstanding the fact that I only did the movie because I thought we would have this moment. But hey, welcome to showbiz, you know? This is what the business is about. So I did my part and I was done. So that's my contribution to the Next Generation movie. I never got to work with the folks who were the regulars, who were the stars of the show. I've gotten to know most of them way after the fact that we were finished shooting and they were finished shooting, and I met them at conventions. And I'm totally grateful for that because I really like these people. I really like them. The people who are supposed to be distant and not personal with other people, I became good friends. Well, I don't know. I thought we were good friends. They may not think that. But my ego tells me they loved me.
They do, Walter. They do.
Okay.
It seems that you weren't the only one that Berman pulled the bait and switch on, because, of course, the scene we just watched, the orbital skydiving scene, is the scene that got Bill involved in the movie, too. He wanted an action scene, and they wrote that for him, and then that was one of the first things that, you know, was cut out of the rough cut. So you were in good company with that.
Yeah, I have another little anecdote. I don't know if you guys were prepared for me to talk my head off here, but...
We had hoped.
That is...
So I'm sitting in a green room. I'm sitting in a green room with a bunch of people. Green room is where we go to on recess, you know, and we relax. And there's a room full of people, and Bill is on the corner of this couch, and I'm on the other corner. And the couch is huge. So when the room is full, it's like being, you know, in two different areas entirely. But then something happened, and the room emptied. It just, everybody left, except Walter Koenig and Bill Shatner at the other end. So, and you know, we weren't on great terms at that point. And I called out to him, "Hey, Bill! Why did you allow?" I mean, he had so much power. He was so, you know, so important to the integrity of the show, to its credibility, to its endurance. I'm really not sure there would have been a third year if Bill hadn't been involved. Okay, so I give him all due gratitude and acknowledgement for his contribution, which I think was outstanding. As an actor, he was just very outstanding. I said, "Why did you let them kill you like that?" I said, "This is Captain Kirk." And he said, I didn't feel I had a choice. I, you know, I guess he really felt that way. You know, after all, it was about Picard and it was Patrick Stewart and all those folks. But I just felt this is not the way you have a hero, such a consummate hero, die on screen. I mean, if you're going to kill him off, you kill him off in a situation where he's being heroic, where he's really, you know, doing something important. And this was just such a throwaway to me. It was just, it was insulting. I was insulted for him, probably more than he was insulted for himself. So my conversation with him. It actually goes on, and I realized I don't want to get into the rest of it. So that's really all I have about that movie.
You talked about, though, and this is the last thing I want to ask you about Generations, that when you were filming those scenes on the bridge of the Bee, you felt like a guest star because it was weird to be on the set of the Enterprise, but it wasn't your movie. And then who would have thought that Alan Ruck would turn out to be an Emmy Award-nominated actor who was playing the captain in that
he went on to
Succession. Mm-hmm. I think so.
By the way, a great guy. Terrific guy. I ran into him at the dry cleaners about a week ago. And he asked me if I was still doing conventions. And I said, yeah. And he says, you know, I'd like to be doing more. So the agent who represents me for this convention is here. And actually, he had spoken to him. So I was going to give him the message that John would like to be in at more conventions, maybe more appearances.
He should do all those Succession conventions. Oh, wait, yeah, they're not. Yeah. So
you know what my feelings about Succession? Everybody watch that show?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody watch that show?
Oh, yeah. Anyway.
You know what ellipses are? Ellipses are the little dots between in a sentence when it's kind of pausing and you're not actually talking. That's the show of the ellipses. And that show, I'm sorry, I have to get up. And that show, people talk for a little bit and then they stop and then they start again. It drives me crazy. It drives me freaking crazy. It's evidently it started with one actor and then the other actor started picking it up. And now they all do it. They all do it, except John. John says he does not do that.
It's like Shatner.
Yeah, but different. Yeah.
Shatner is more of a dash than a dot, dot, dot.
As opposed to dot, dot, dot. Yeah. Okay, I'll concede that.
But it's interesting that you said in Generations you wanted lines, dialogue that was germane to your character. Because there are points in which it sounds like you're literally reading DeForest Kelly's lines.
I was reading DeForest. I swear to you, that's the truth. Instead of writing new dialogue for the rest of it, other than my scene that I wrote, they gave me Dee's lines. Because Dee was supposed, this show was written for all seven of us. Then it was written for those three. Right. And then when two of the three, Leonard and DeForest, decided not to do it, then they brought in Jimmy and I. And rather than rewrite the lines, which you would think they would do, they just gave me DeForest lines. And they put me in the infirmary.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Before you go off to Trek 3, I want to ask you about a little excursion you did a few years ago. You're the first real actor to be in a fan film that was written by the great Dorothy Fontana.
Yeah.
And it's called To Serve All My Days. And it was for James Cawley and his group up in New York. And it's an absolutely touching, wonderful episode for Chekhov. And I wonder if you could talk about that experience a little bit.
Well, first of all, I'm the one that recommended Dorothy.
Yes.
I got her involved. I said, you know, use a professional if you're going to do this. I just thought here was one of those opportunities where I got to be more than just an instrument of plot, you know, where you get to know Chekhov. He goes through denial. He goes through, you know, all the feelings that one goes through. And Cawley was cooperative, and Dorothy wrote a lovely script. And so I was, you know, I'm an actor first. And I want the opportunity to do something that's dimensional.
And to add to the history of the character.
What?
And to add to the history of the character.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But my ending, the ending that I asked Dorothy to consider, was that Chekhov died. Mm-hmm. And I told them, I told James and his group, I said, I'll do this as long as we are loyal to the ending that Dorothy wrote, that Chekhov dies. And they said, must we? And I said, that's the only way that I'll do it. Yeah. So that was the idea. And of course the fans got very upset. That was not canon, you know. And after we had shot it and Chekhov had died, I felt like, okay, I had done my part. And then they called me and they begged me, please let us make it that Chekhov doesn't die. The fans are going nuts, you know. And I said, okay, I don't care anymore. I did it the way I wanted it. You know, in my head, Chekhov died. I'm just kind of naive, and I didn't see the whole picture, I guess. But I felt I was okay. By then, I was okay with the idea of them doing this ridiculous ending.
You can find it online still. It's a beautiful episode. So look for it.
And I want to take you back. It's the 40th anniversary next year of Star Trek III. Now, you were coming off doing Star Trek II, which was the meatiest role you had had in any of the movies.
Right.
And had a great experience doing that. You got to work with Paul Winfield, and Ricardo, and largely away from the principal cast. And it was just a great experience for you, great script. Obviously, it's a classic film. Now, Star Trek III is greenlit. Tell us about your initial reaction, because you had a really good relationship with Harv on Star Trek II, and yet Star Trek III seemed to be a step back for the character in terms of your role and what you're being asked to do. What was sort of your initial response when Star Trek III came across your desk?
Well, being a very generous, benevolent, kind, sensitive soul, I was really pissed off. I had heard rumors. I hadn't seen the script at one point. I had heard rumors that Chekhov's role in III was not going to be as good as it was in II. And then I heard more rumors. And by the time I got to the studio, I came with my agent. In fact, he drove me. And there's a point for me telling you this. We drove in his car. And I was already defensive about it. I was going to read, and my sense was, and I guess it should be every actor's sense. You are in some part driven by your ego, you know, and your sense of worth. And I felt, well, I did okay in II. Certainly, I should have as much to do in III. And that wasn't the case. It was definitely a step back. It was definitely several steps back. And Harv Bennett, who met us, my agent and I, as we came through the doors of the studio, the gates of the studio, actually sensed that I wasn't happy. Even at that juncture, he sensed. And he asked us to read the script, because it hadn't been released yet to anybody, read the script in his outer office, and then we would discuss it after we read it. So we read it, and it was, as I had anticipated, a step in two or three back from what I had already done and what I felt I was going to do. I, you know, ego is plays a part. You just think that you've made enough of a point, you've proven yourself enough that you get rewarded for it. You don't get demoted for it, you know? So, but I was willing to sit there after I've read it and talk about it with Harv. I have no problem with that. I don't shrink from in the face of authority. But my agent had to go somewhere, and he had driven us there. So I was compelled to go with him. When Bennett came down and found that we had gone, he was furious. He was freaking furious, and that's not the word I really mean. So he called my agent, did not tell him that we came in his car, did not tell him that he was the one that demanded that we leave, and just took it down that I was being given a take it or leave it offer. Mm. And that's what he communicated to me, that my offer was an initial offer, was a take it or leave it offer. Now, in showbiz, I don't know if it's written anywhere where it's an actual law, take it or leave it, but it always means the same thing. This is the last shot, guys. You either take it or you leave it. So when they called me, my agent called me to tell me that I've been given this offer, I said, I leave it. And I turned to my family and I said, I'm no longer involved in Star Trek. You know, the work is important. You know, no matter how small it is, how incidental it is to the bigger picture, it's still your work and you want to be acknowledged for it. And I could not deal with the idea that I was being put in this spot, that I had to take it or leave it. So I said, I'd leave it. 10 o'clock the next morning, brrring, new offer.
Now it's really take it or leave it.
This
real
is the line
for
of
this
death.
Time.
But this time it was okay. This time it, you know, I could live with it. I'm not going to get the chance to be more creative, so I'll be able to buy my kids, you know, bikes or scooters or whatever the hell it was when we were doing it. Yeah, so I very nearly wasn't in three, and Bennett and I never talked during the course of that movie.
So do you think that the Pushkin collar was kind of your punishment jacket for walking out?
Was that three?
Yeah. On the bridge in the pink yeah. outfit.
Oh, that's right. You know why
dress.
I remember it was three? Because of that. I went to they put me in this pink outfit, guys. And it's not my disposition, you know what I can tell you. And went to Dailies the next day and I saw it. And Leonard came up to me and said, I'm not happy with the costume. We're going to change your costume. I said, thank God. Very interesting moment. Because he turned to me and he was really angry. Why didn't you say something? And I didn't say something was because I was still operating under this caste system of superior and subordinate. And I was still one of the subordinate actors. I didn't think I had a voice. I didn't think I was in a position to determine whether I was going to be in the movie or not, because that was my choice. But I didn't think I was in a position to say I don't like the costume. So he was upset with me because he didn't understand where I was coming from. He didn't understand where I felt I was in the order of things.
Because he was never in that position on the show.
No, he was never in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was so distant. I mean, bless his heart. Leonard was a good human being. He was a good. His philosophy was good. His politics were good.
Not so good.
Pardon?
His music not so good.
Yeah. But as a fellow actor, forget about it, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't exist. And for me, He didn't exist because we never had an interchange. He was always Mr. Spock. And that's why he was so good at it. Because he really, really was the... That's why everybody else who's played Spock is pretending for me. Only Leonard Nimoy was Mr. Spock. That's the way I sense.
What was your response when you first heard he was directing? Because you had just come off a very good, fruitful, creative experience with Nick Meyer. And now you're told that Leonard Nimoy, your fellow castmate, Spock, is directing the movie. What was your response? And what was your experience being directed by him once you got out of the Pushkin collar?
That's interesting. I had actually auditioned for Leonard when he was directing a play. The play was called, do you know the name of the play?
No.
No. Neither do I. But it was pretty much, it was a good part. It wasn't the lead. And I didn't know him, but he had me. I literally auditioned for well over an hour. I believe it was with several different actors playing opposite. It was not Endgame, but it was something with two words, and it had to do with a prison. In any case, so I had auditioned for him before, and I thought, having auditioned for well over an hour, that I had the part. And it turned out I didn't. So, but it wasn't crushing, because I hadn't any kind of commitment to it yet, you know? So my feeling was, he's such a bright guy, and he knows his stuff, that this is not gonna be difficult. What I didn't know, there's two general ways of directing. It's by commission and omission. Commission, you're very active. You're talking to the actors all the time. I had that experience in a couple of TV shows where I actually literally stopped the show and I took the director inside and said, you can't stop me every two lines. I'm up there waiting for you to stop me. And that's all I'm thinking about. You've got to not stop me. Let me finish. You don't like it, we'll do it again. And I remember Vince McAvity, that was the name of the director. And he says, okay. And then we were fine after that. Well, Leonard was of the omission school of directing. He said nothing if you were doing it right. And when you learn that very quickly, you're okay. You know, you don't need a pat on the head if you know that it's going well because he's not giving you notes. We had a moment when we wake up outside of the, where the hell we was, we were supposed to be sleeping, was an exterior. I think this is where Spock was being held or something. Well, one of the actors did this.
Waking up.
That's known as cliche. And Leonard yelled, stop! Went over to the actor, didn't look at the actor, and just said, don't do that again. And the actor didn't do that again. But that was when he, only when he spoke. Otherwise, you know, he figured everything was fine. You know, he wasn't unpleased with what you were doing.
And you had an old friend on that picture, Christopher Lloyd, who you'd gone to school with, you grew up with, Chris Lloyd?
Chris Lloyd, yeah. We were best buddies at the Neighborhood Playhouse, which is a drama school. He thought I was funny, you know, which was great. He's a delightful guy, very, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Well, he dressed, and his history reflected the character he played on Taxi. He was supposed to be, you know, kind of a guy that didn't have any money and was, you know, just wandering around. He came from enormous wealth, Chris Lloyd did. I went up to his home in Connecticut, and it was a two-story home with elevators. Elevators! And an organ, I'm talking about the musical kind. That was two stories high. So he was great. When we were best buddies, as I told you, all through school, and then I came out to L.A., and then he came out a little while later, and somewhere along the line, I learned that he came from all this money, and he was a Tesco fortune. Okay, so the point of my story is, we were doing Star Trek One, and he was shooting Taxi.
Yeah.
So I went over to his dressing room, and I hadn't seen him. I mean, we hung out together when he first came to L.A., and then we drifted apart. So I hadn't seen him in a couple of years, and I knocked on his dressing room door, and the door opened, and he came out, and I say, "Chris, you go, that was him talking to me. And I'm saying, he's playing Jim, is that his name?
Yeah, Reverend Jim, yeah.
He's playing the freaking character to me. What the hell is that about? So I said, well, obviously, Jim isn't here. I mean, Chris isn't here, so I'll leave. So, several years go by, Star Trek III. I'm sitting there, he comes in, and I swear to you, he looks at me and kind of smiles, and I'm saying, he's feeling guilty. He knows what the hell he did. So I couldn't stay angry at him. You know, if you're admitting in some way that you screwed up, that you were a jerk, I totally forgive you for that. So we got along good after that. Well, got along well.
Yeah. Okay. Is it? Was it tough to go off and promote that movie when it wasn't something that you really felt like? I mean, you know, at the time there was Starlog and there were all these magazines, Entertainment Tonight had just started, and you're doing all these interviews and you're going to conventions. But you came off Star Trek II where you really felt you made this vital contribution, and you did, and you were wonderful in it. And in Star Trek II, it's more thankless for you, right? You didn't get the creative satisfaction. Is it hard to then go out and tub thump and promote and sing its praises when you're not satisfied with what happened?
Well, maybe there's a degree involved, you know, instead of feeling 110% promoting it, I felt 105. I'm still loyal to Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
I still feel grateful to Star Trek. I mean, you know, they didn't get Gregory Peck or John Wayne when they got me, you know. They just got this little guy who had a funny accent. So I've always felt grateful for this opportunity. I mean, if you got to be remembered by something or by identified with a particular show, you can't do better than Star Trek because it promoted the things that I believe in, you know. So I got over the ego stuff pretty quickly. And then, of course, we're not talking about Star Trek IV, but that was the best fun I ever had involved with Star Trek. So I certainly have no...
It was almost like an apology, because all of a sudden now you got this great role. Like, Bennett maybe realized he gave you too little because in IV, and of course Nick Meyer was back writing the script. That helped too, because Nick was a fan. And had Leonard changed it all in his directing? Because in III, the studio was all over him. And he it was a lower budget, and they weren't convinced that he could do it. On IV, he, as he famously said, the training wheels are off, right? And he got a lot more control over that picture. Did you feel Leonard had changed it all, or not really?
Well, the first person I give credit to, always, is the writer. I read the script again before we started shooting, and it was so classically structured. I mean, it was the way you want a screenplay that covers territory like this to be played. You had great conflict, but honest conflict. You didn't have a monster. You didn't have a hairy beast that grew out of the ground or a mechanical creature you know, that clinked when it walked. You had a human being, certainly a more intense version, but a human being who had a some justification for his anger. I'm talking about. Wait a second. I'm getting confused, folks. You gotta forgive me. I'm 87 freaking years old. And I sometimes forget where the hell I am at. No, with Star Trek II, that I thought was so well constructed. I mean, it was the absolute perfect screenplay. Really bad guy, really formidable conflict, but you can still, you could still identify with that character, Ricardo Montalban's character, because he was feeling, you know, he was feeling anger and pain and vengeance and those are things that we all experience at some point or another. Okay, Star Trek IV.
Well, he wanted to kill Admiral Kirk, kind of like you did at the time.
Wait a second.
I said he wanted to kill Admiral Kirk, which is sort of how you felt at the time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Let's go on to something.
Let's bring up some questions, because I know that you have a lot of questions for Walter, and let's give him a chance to answer some of those.
I don't know if it's a faux pas to ask about Babylon 5. In a Star Trek.
Yes, you have to leave now.
Yeah. I loved your work in Babylon 5, and if anybody hasn't seen it, it's so good. What was it like being approached to play Mr. Bester, and how did that contrast with playing on Star Trek?
Well, you got to understand that you may have been watching Star Trek episodes, but they were way into reruns. We hadn't done Star Trek in 10 or 12 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So, first of all, there was no problem of my, you know, shaking off the Chekhov character to play Bester. Years had gone by. And besides which, I'm an actor. You're supposed to be able to play more than one character, you know? So, it never was a problem for me. I never felt like, oh, that's too much like Chekhov or something. It was a different time, a different environment, a different group. I got along really well with these folks. They treated me well. You know, this was so many years after Star Trek that I was no longer considered, you know, a subordinate character. And when Bester arrived on the scene, what's happening? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, so I thoroughly enjoyed playing Bester. I thoroughly enjoyed working with Bruce and Jerry and Christina and Christina, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all those people. They absolutely treated me like I was one of the group, even though I only appeared, you know, 12 times in 5 years. So that was a great experience. My indebtedness, of course, however, is to Star Trek. I mean, all that had happened, including probably B5, occurred because I had been...
the photographer, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, we have another question.
Hi there, I'm Katie, and a couple of weeks ago, news came out that you were going to be doing a Star Trek, the original series rewatch with Sir Rock Lofton and Ryan T. Husk with The Seventh Rule. I was wondering, why did you decide to do that at this stage in your life?
Because it is this stage in my life, you know. I am not, nobody's pounding on my door, you know. Mr. 87-year-old, we got a role for you. It's not happening. And I'd like to be busy, you know. I wake up in the morning, I'm alone. I need a reason to get out of bed. I mean, I'm sorry if this is too raw, but this is what one experiences in life. You know, you go through life and at some juncture, you're gonna find yourself in a situation like this. So It sounds like fun. It sounds like, you know, something to look forward to, something to do a couple of times a month, you know? I'm just hoping that I remember those episodes. I mean, they're going to ship me the episodes in advance, so I'll have chance to make things up if I can't remember anything.
Well, thank you, and you don't look a day over 70 at least.
But Walter, I think it's an interesting thing to have you watching these episodes. And it's even better if you don't remember things about it so that you can experience the way we did with, you know, a clean slate, so that you can experience the story and see how it affects you as a person.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's a good question. That's a good way of answering it. Yeah. Can I write that?
Because we would love to have you feel the joy of watching these shows the way we did.
Good, yeah. And it was generally, you know, quite positive, you know. Even, good. You know, I took off for a month. I don't know if everybody knows that. In the third season of Star Trek, I had an opportunity to do a play outside of Chicago with Jackie Coogan from the Addams Family. You remember Jackie Coogan from the Addams Family? Yeah. There's nobody here old enough to remember Jackie Coogan as Charlie Chaplin's...
As the kid, yeah.
The kid, you know. But he goes back that far. He goes, Jackie Coogan goes back to acting opposite Charlie Chaplin. And it was delightful. I had a terrific time. I think he did too. We just got along famously. So what the hell is the point of my saying that?
You took a month off.
Oh, I took, yeah, so I took a month off. So why did I say that?
there were some episodes that you weren't in that you will now be able to experience.
There was a what?
There were some episodes that you weren't in.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yeah, well, that's true. The one where Kirk says, if I want to check off, he says to Sulu, I want to check off here. Do you remember which one that is? I thought you would all know that. then I would have had check off. That was one that started shooting on the last day of my work in the play. So if I could have gotten off one day earlier, I could have flown back and been in that episode. But, you know, you can't leave a play. Certainly when there's no understudy, you know, you have to finish the play. So, yeah, that was the only thing. Perhaps that would have been fun. In any case, I don't know what the hell "in any case" means anyway.
Next question, please. And I think it was "That Which Survives." I think that was the episode.
What's that?
"That Which Survives." I may be wrong. I think that was the episode where it says, if I wanted Chekhov here, I would have had him here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's okay. What I'm saying. Okay, next.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi.
I'm here with my daughter, Jenna.
Hi.
From Illinois.
Yes.
We loved you as Chekhov. It's wonderful to meet you as Walter. And I'm glad you're doing awesome. Your health seems to be reasonably well. Did you ever, as a pilot in TOS, did you ever take any aviating lessons?
It's any what?
Aviation lessons.
Oh, yeah, flying lessons.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
No. My secret little fantasy is jumping out of a plane. You know, I would love to do that. But at the same time, I'm terrified of the idea. Yeah, that's what makes it so appealing, is that, you know, you're conflicted by the idea of what a glorious moment, you know, to leap into the air. And then be able to pull the string, you know. But
thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
We're almost out of time, so let's try and do a lightning round. Quick question.
Oh,
Walter
gosh.
Will answer, and we'll try and get through as many people as we can.
So,
and the photographer will take lots of pictures.
Hi, I'm Jerry. I'm a recovering motion picture professional.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
28 years.
Wait a second.
28 years in the industry because of Star Trek, and survived my life because of Star Trek. Oh, goodness.
Oh, there
and
he
here
goes.
We go.
Oh, man.
Yay.
Michael Rooker, ladies
Stop
and gentlemen.
The landing.
I just want to hold your hand. Go ahead. Go ahead, sir.
So, Anton Yelchin.
Yes.
You as the originator of the role, like in a Broadway play, when you talked with him, and you, I assume you've seen some of that, how does that make you feel to see your character evolve in that way?
Okay, you're gonna be okay?
I'm fine, are you all right?
I'm gonna go have a little lay down and I'll be okay. Well, I met Anton. I was invited to the set by JJ for the first Star Trek movie they made. And he wasn't even scheduled to come in that day, and he came in. And we talked for a couple of hours. I found him to be extremely bright. I already knew how talented he was. And very, very social. And we got I thought we got along great. I thoroughly enjoyed that opportunity. When I went to see the... I was invited to the premiere, and I wasn't sure how I was going to respond to that. You've already gotten some inkling into the fact that I'm pretty neurotic, you know? I wasn't sure whether I'd be able to have a generous soul and be able to applaud everybody's performance, or whether I'd feel that I have become discarded, you know, that I'm no longer pertinent to events, that I've lost my credibility and my acknowledgement of who I am. I loved the movie, and I was so pleased with myself that I enjoyed the movie. You know, that all those feelings that I was concerned that I might engulf me, that might embrace me, I didn't feel that way at all. And when he tries to do the accent, you know, with the V and the W, I cracked up. I thought that was terrific. Particularly because he didn't believe for a moment that Russians spoke that way.
Right.
Which is not true. Because my old man spoke that way. He spoke with the W instead of the V. That's where I got it from. Anyway, the little anecdote that goes with Anton Yeltsin is after it's over, and I'm so pleased with myself that I enjoyed it so much, you know, that I was a good guy, my soul was intact. There's a big party in the parking lot, and all the actors are there, and each one has a group of people, you know, journalists, reporters, camera people around them. And I'm walking through, and Anton is there with his group of people, and he sees me, and he yells out, "Walter! Walter! I've got my own Chekhov doll!" Okay, can we maybe move on?
Yeah, well, let's do one or two more questions, and we got to call it.
Hi, I'm Kina. I'm from Cincinnati. Talking about wanting to come back if it adds something to your character, how did you get involved with doing the cameo in Picard season 3?
In which?
In Picard season 3.
The cameo in season 3.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was fun. Hold on. Oh, I jumped off. Yeah. Is that it?
Walter King.
Walter King. He's back.
No, that was fun. Todd.
Stashwick. Yeah, Todd, yeah. Stashwick.
Lives a block and a half from me. And I ran into him walking my dog. And we exchanged greetings. And I'm a little foggy on how it occurred, but he evidently talked to Terry, who was here, the showrunner. And Terry said that he'd like to talk to me about a contribution to the show. So we spoke, and this is an interesting thing. This has happened a couple of times with Star Trek. Necessity is the mother of invention. And in this particular case, they wanted initially, evidently, to have me on screen, have my image on screen. But they ran out of time, they ran out of money, whatever it was, they ran out of stuff, so they had to go with just a voice. Now, my first reaction when I heard that was, well, that's too bad. You know, everybody wants to be on screen. Everybody, and I would have liked to have been on screen. But my sense is that wasn't, there's really a bug here. I'm not just. So what I realized, though, was that when people got a chance, when people got a chance to discover for themselves who it was more rewarding for them, the fans, than it would have been if they seen me originally. Because this took a moment to solve. You know, who's that voice? Oh, my God, that voice is Walter Koenig. As opposed to, boy, there I am on screen. That would have been a surprise. But I really think it worked better to the advantage of the show.
I think it absolutely did. Yeah.
That they got to discover through the voice. And I heard, you know, that's the reaction that the folks had when they had a screening of it, a public screening of the show before it was on the air. I don't know if you all know that. And the fans were pretty excited about it. Okay.
Okay, well, Walter, it has been a joy, as always, having you here. What a great way to finish Galaxy Con. Walter Koenig, ladies and gentlemen.
And please don't leave.
Hey, we're back. And that was our conversation with Walter Koenig live at Columbus at a great GalaxyCon. And of course, you know, you can join us at GalaxyCon. We're going to be in Richmond, Virginia next month in March. We're going to be interviewing a lot of these great Trek guests, celebrities. We'll be, you know, doing what we do. We'll have a booth where we'll have a bunch of posters that we sign. You get to talk to the Trek experts. We may even talk back.
That's right.
Darren and Ashley will talk back. I'll walk away.
Mark talks back sometimes.
It depends. Depends if I got enough sleep. So
Him anything with the free enterprise on it and he'll sign it.
That's true. You notice I'm much nicer to the people who have me sign free enterprise stuff.
Lesson learned, people.
Yeah.
You know, you can also hand me free enterprise stuff because I was.
I know. I even said to people, I said, you should have Darren sign it too. He's in the movie.
They don't care.
And you can hand me stuff. I'll just sign it as Robert Meyer Burnett.
That's right.
I am just so glad to see Walter going through this late career renaissance and just seeing him take this victory lap because the fans love him. They love him.
And he is so glorious.
I'm excited that he's going to be watching the episodes. Because, you know, like I feel about all the Star Trek actors, I wanted them to enjoy it a bit as much as we have.
He more than anyone will appreciate it. Because he's always been a bit of a Star Trek historian. You know, he's written these books himself, like Chekhov's Enterprise and On the Good Ship Enterprise. He's always had a fact. He was very helpful to Mark Cushman when he was writing his book. He's always had an interest, I think, it's beyond his own role, unlike the other actors, which is really interesting. And he's, I think, very knowledgeable. I haven't heard what the Seventh Rule is doing with him, but I love those guys, Ryan Husk and Sirach, and they do a good podcast. And I'm happy that they're doing this with Walter. They're not doing the first season for obvious reasons. Although I think it would be interesting for them to do the first season.
Yeah.
Because he would still have perspective on what it was like to be on the sets and actually, you know, what he thought of the episodes. And as someone who experienced being at Desilu, I think he would have a lot to offer beyond just Chekhov. Because remember, Chekhov's barely in these episodes. It's not like the second season, you know, he's going to have, you know, all these unique Chekhov insights.
Right, right.
You know, plus when you get to Space Eating, he could tell that story again.
That's right.
How he's in the bathroom.
See, that's the thing to do, right? It's like you do the, you do that as a briefing room where you just bring him in to do Space Seed.
The entire first season, I'm always in the bathroom.
I mean, it's so ridiculous because he wasn't on the show for people saying canon that Chekhov was not on the Enterprise. Of course he was on the Enterprise.
Of course he was.
He just hadn't been promoted to the bridge yet.
He was in the lower decks, folks.
That's right. He was down there with Mariner.
On that ship.
Boimler.
Well, I know they should do Lower Decks, and it's like, it's the Lower Decks of the first season of Star Trek.
That actually would be an interesting episode or show in which you see the lower decks for all these original Star Trek adventures, but from the perspective of the crew members on the lower decks.
Right.
So when
during the same episodes.
That's right.
Yeah, right. During the exactly. During the same episode. So like during Balance of Terror, while he's playing all this stuff, you know, people down the lower decks.
That's a way better idea for an animated crossover than
Short treks.
It's the misadventures of Chekhov and Kyle.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there's so much you could do there. Then you could even have Chapel. Yeah. Then you have Chapel. What's going on? You know, it's like.
You know, I mean, they're always like getting high with her and shit. Like, you know.
But it'd be so interesting that Rashomon of like when these significant episodes were going on.
Yeah.
You know, what was happening, you know, like. You know, alternative factor. The guy's going to be looking at his bong thinking, what is going on? I smoke too much or whatever. Because he's like, the universe is blinking in and out of existence. And it's because of this guy in a bubble car who's from another dimension.
Well, plus, you know, during any of the space battles and the whole ship is shaking and they say, what's going on? I have no idea.
Yeah, I have no idea. Look out a window. but that was the one thing I did like that in the original Star Trek, and certainly in the cage, they would often go on the PA system and tell the crew what was going on.
Right.
And realize, look, there's other people on the ship besides the people that are on the bridge.
The crew stands in the hallway looking up, looking stupid.
Everyone, we just want you to know there is a giant ship made out of balls in front of us.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think there's a lot of potential here. Somebody get Mike McMahon on the phone. We got to have him on the show. I really like Mike, and I know you're a huge fan of Lower Decks, and it would be fun. I gotta talk to him about coming on the show. I like Mike. Oh yeah, that was Walter Koenig. That was fun talking. that was fun. And the great thing is, we will talk to Walter, I'm sure, again. We always enjoy talking to him. It's always something new to talk to him about. You know, we never get tired talking to Walter. And thankfully, he hasn't gotten tired of talking to us yet, and was amazingly complimentary. He's like, "How do you guys know all this?" I said, "We wasted a lot of time in front of the television over the years watching this Fakakta show.
Useless now."
I felt like sometimes we were in that Saturday Night Live sketch with Shatner at the convention. Like again, even just standing there with him at Bag Claim, he's like, you know, I wrote an episode of the animated series, The Infant Vulcan. Yes. It's like, yes.
That's really funny.
Motherfucker.
It's funny. I was helping my daughter with some homework yesterday. I was like talking about the Monroe doctrine. And it's like, Monroe doctrine. And it's like, I barely could remember anything about that, but I can remember everything about freaking Star Trek. I'm like, something is seriously wrong here. It's like,
well, in fairness, you couldn't have turned the Monroe Doctrine into a career.
That's true. The 50-year Monroe Doctrine.
That's right. The oral history of the Monroe Doctrine.
The oral history of the Lewis and Clark expedition. It would be like, wow, that would sell at least 3 books.
That's right.
Okay. So, Walter, thank you as always. We love having you on the show. We love spending time with you. Obviously, that comes across. And you rock. And we want to remind you that if you want to support our documentary, as Terry Farrell and the Trekspirits visit Star Trek's greatest locations and to boldly go, visit MakeTheTrek.com today. MakeTheTrek.com. It'll tell you how you can join us and grow stronger through the sharing. We want to extend our special thanks to the great Mark Rivera for making it sound so good. And Peter Holmstrom, of course, who's been pulling some of these great clips that you've been listening to. And of course, you can rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast platform, which helps bring people to the show. So make sure to rate us 5 stars and leave a review if you can. We may read it on a future show. And you can subscribe to our subscriber-only podcast, Deck 78, at Trekspirits Plus, and join our new Discord channel on the Trekspirits Screening Room, as well as other special bonuses for being a Trekspirits Plus subscriber. And you can let us know what you think of this and every Inglourious Trekspirits episode on social. I like Star Trek 3. I don't know why you don't like it. I like Star Trek 3. You know nothing. You know nothing. I like Star Trek 3. Okay, we get it. You like Star Trek 3.
Good to like things.
Here's the thing. We like it too. It's just not a good movie.
Yeah.
The two things can exist together in the same space.
Exactly. Like we like you, but and you're not a good person. It does. It's
it's not like the defiant interface where it can't exist in the same space. It can be a fun movie that we enjoy and not be a good movie. Okay. That's all we're saying. But I like Star Trek 3. Okay. We got it. So let us know what you think of this and every Inglourious Treksperts episode, including Star Trek 3, on social at Inglourious Trek on all social channels or email us at treksperts+@gmail.com. So on behalf of Ashley Edward Miller, Darren R. Doctorman, and myself, Mark A. Altman, don't call us tiny. Hey, Darren, there's this rumor going around that you got a new podcast.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's Treksperts adjacent. It's a fun thing. It's called The Weirded Beardos. Yeah, and before you react, it's Kirk Thatcher, our favorite punk on the bus, and myself just talking about stuff.
But I hate him.
You don't hate him.
No, I'm kidding. I'm doing a song from Star Trek 4. I hate you, right?
I hate you. I berate you.
Oh, yeah. But I don't berate him and I don't hate him. And if he's involved with you, then I love you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, it's basically just us talking about sort of all things related to our history of working in the industry. You know, together we have like 78 years of experience working in the entertainment biz.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I thought it was about maintaining your beards or something.
It has nothing to do with beards, actually, which is kind of funny. But it's fun. We basically hang out for an hour every other week. So come and join us. Look for the Weirded Beardos on Spotify if you just want to hear the audio. And we're actually on YouTube as well, The Weirded Beardos.
Great. Can't wait to check it out.
Thanks.
First start of the right and straight on till morning.